Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is author and podcaster David Sparks. David, good afternoon.
Hi, John.
Thanks for being on the show. It's nice to have you.
Oh, my pleasure.
David is a noted Macworld author and podcaster. He's done over 300 podcasts with Katie Floyd, and has started a new series with Jason Snell, and is a Macintosh and Apple expert. And so it's nice to have you on the show.
Like I said, I was really happy when you wrote me.
Cool. Well, you are a practicing attorney, but I want to go back in time a little bit. Tell me how you came to become an attorney. And were you, is that something you always wanted to do?
No, I kind of fell into it, really. I mean, I do think that To Kill a Mockingbird played a role, you know, because I always had this idea of it. But when I was in college, I started out as an engineering student and thought, you know, well, I'll be an engineer. I was in aerospace engineering, doing fine in my classes. And one of the things I noted was that most of the engineers I knew were super inarticulate. You know, they were great at a lot of things, but like talking to people, they weren't very good at it. I thought, well, that's a skill as an engineer that I should work on. And so I joined the debate team in college, and and I found out I was really good at it. And I was, we would go, and at one point I was ranked second in a national tournament. So I felt like, you know, I got some chops with this. And there was an actual judge who was a judge of the tournament as well, who said, you know, you should think about law school. And that's when kind of the old days of law school kind of came back to my head. And I switched gears halfway through college and ended up an attorney.
Where did you go to law school?
Pepperdine out on the California on the Pacific coast here.
Ah, I've heard of them. You know, you're talking to a former Lockheed Martin engineer, so be careful.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I worked for Lockheed Martin for most of my career.
Yeah, that was the path I was on, and it was during the Reagan years, so, you know, you thought there was no end to budgets and jobs for aerospace engineering.
Yeah, that's how I got started. Ronald Reagan conceived this idea. I don't know if it was him specifically, but he was a spokesman for the Strategic Defense Initiative in the
80s. Wars.
Yeah, it was euphemistically called Star Wars. I had written an Apple II program that came to the attention of a Lockheed, at that time it was Martin Marietta engineer. And they got together and invited me up to Denver, and the rest is history. Yeah.
A friend of mine worked on the mirror for those out in the, I think it was New Mexico desert for years. He worked on the mirrors for those things that never got launched.
Oh, the space-based lasers?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an interesting project. It kind of launched my technical career. So how was law school? Is this something you just kind of just really loved and fell into? Or was it, because we tend to think of law school as being really, you know, dreary and hard and paper chase kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think it's not that bad. I think people that go through it always make it sound worse than it is. Mm-hmm. I was a scholarship kid, and we didn't have any money where I grew up, you know, and so I really was hoping to get a scholarship because my parents couldn't have helped, and I didn't want to be massively in debt to do all this stuff. So I got a scholarship to Pepperdine. I was on a full ride, but I had to stay in the top, I think, 25% of the class. And the problem with law school is you don't know. There's no, like, midterms. There's no quizzes. You go an entire semester with no grading. And
really?
Then at the end, you take
typical?
A test, and that's your grade, you know. So, you know, it was scary for me because I was thinking, man, if I don't get the right grades, I'm going to, you know, be in trouble because I'm going to lose my scholarship. So I worked super hard. Pepperdine University is right on the ocean of the Pacific Ocean in Malibu. I mean, it's a gorgeous campus. You go to you go to the supermarket and Sean Connery is standing behind you with a box of crackers, you know? So, yeah.
Do you ever look out your window and say, why am I in this office studying and should be on the beach?
And I didn't live in Malibu because I couldn't afford it. The proletariat had, there was like, if you went inland about 10 miles through this canyon, there's a cheaper housing for people like me. And so I didn't spend a lot of time in Malibu, but I thought it was funny. But I just did nothing but study. I went crazy. And it worked out. My grades were good and I kept my scholarship and I had a good time getting through law school. But in hindsight, it really wasn't as bad as they say. One of the sayings about law school is it's 3 years. They say the first year they scare you to death, the second year they work you to death, and the third year they bore you to death. And that's kind of true.
I got a question for you because I'm a big fan of a show on USA Today, USA called Suits. And I've always wondered, when you go through law school, is there conscious preparation for the kinds of things that will be presented in the bar exam, or is it orthogonal? Do you have to kind of figure out what you might be quizzed on?
It depends where you go. Pepperdine was what they call an ABA school. It's a nationally licensed school, and they pride themselves on kind of teaching the basics across the board as opposed to teaching for California. There are some what they call California licensed but not ABA licensed schools, and they are much more focused on just California law. So what you do is when you graduate, you go out and take a course. You know, they have like third parties offer a course. I took a course. That's another kind of funny story. I graduated in May and I took the bar in July, at the end of July. And I was getting married like 3 months later. So I did not want to fail the bar because the results were going to come in like the weekend before our wedding. And I did not want to go to my wedding and have to tell everybody I failed the bar. So I studied pretty hard for the bar.
When you're taking the bar, when you look at questions, do you go, yeah, I remember studying that in one of my first year classes. This is basic stuff. Or do they try to come at you with stuff that's rare and that you really have to be on the lookout for?
The California bar is pretty challenging. But I took a course. There's courses you could take. So I took a bar prep course, which a lot of people did. And I remember they had this, it's a 3-day test, and the second day is these multiple choice questions. And, you know, growing up, you always knew multiple choice. There's like two you can knock off immediately, then there's two that are kind of hard, and you got to pick between them.
I know where you're going.
On the bar exam, they all seem like legitimate answers. And at the time, my father had passed away recently, and I was, so I moved back in with my mom, and there was a room in her house that I think I probably did, I'm not over exaggerating, I probably did 10,000 practice questions, multiple choice questions in that room. And years later, 20 years later, when she died and I went back and was cleaning out some of her house and I go into that room, I still get this chill when I go into that room. It's quite an experience. But go back to law school. I'll tell you the thing that's weird about law school is it's not that the workload is bad. It's that a lot of times it's the other students that make you crazy, because the law has some really great people in it and it has some really terrible people in it. And it's like there's no middle ground. So that's hard.
Well, in what way are they terrible?
Okay. The first day of law school, one of my classes, the teacher was in the process of publishing a book for the class that wasn't done yet. So we had to go to the library to copy the cases. You know, in law school, they teach Socratic method where you read prior cases and then they don't tell you what the law is. You have to kind of glean it from the decisions. And then you're questioned on it in class. So we were all going to the library to make copies of these two or three cases we need to read for the next day. And there was a student ahead of me in line making copies. And she wasn't copying the same book I was. She had something else she was doing. But she was copying, you know, one page at a time. And the copier had a large piece of glass, and I was a nerd. You know, I'm still a nerd, right? And I said, hey, you know, if you just press that reduce button, it will fit it all on, you know, one larger size paper and save you a bunch of money and time, you know? Mm-hmm. And I said it very nicely. I think I did. I'm not really an aggressive person. And she like bit my head off. I know that, you know, and she's like, you know, she's really like angry at me, you know? And then I said, okay. So she wasn't going to do it my way. And, And then I saw there was another room that had copiers in it. I didn't realize it was the first day, you know. So I'm, oh, there's copiers. So I went in the other room and made my copies. And as I'm walking out, I walked past and she's still making copies. And she had pressed the reduce button after I left and was doing it the way I suggested. And I'll never forget that, because I sat down and I said, okay, Dave, this is an opportunity for you. You are not that far into this and you're on a scholarship. So do you want to spend the rest of your life dealing with people like that? Because, you know, it's not too late to get off this train. And I literally sat there for 10 minutes and contemplated whether or not this was the right career for me.
And did you have a mind to go into a particular aspect like criminal law, defense attorney, prosecution, business?
When I started, I wanted to be a prosecutor. You know, I just wanted to be, you know, I just, that's, you know, I wanted to be in trial every day. And and I spent one summer interning in the criminal justice system, and that was enough to teach me I didn't want to do that. The one thing I knew I didn't want to do was corporate law. And when I got out of law school, I got a job with a small business litigation firm and eventually started doing corporate law. So there you go.
How did you come to realize that you didn't want to be in the prosecution side? Was it the fanaticism? Was it the cutting corners? Was it
just the way the whole system is just such a, it's just such a train wreck. That's a whole other podcast.
Too much emphasis on checking the boxes and getting prosecutions. I don't know.
There's a lot of really great people making it work, but it is such a difficult thing. And, you know, and the cases, one of the problems, one of my primary failings as a lawyer is I have too much empathy. And when I see the things that these people have gone through, you know, really on both sides, it's just too hard for me to disengage. It's the same reason why I could never do family law. To sit there and argue about somebody else's kids, it would just kill me. But I got into a small business practice where a lot of the clients were these small businessmen or small businesses. And I found that it was really rewarding for me, because these small businesses, they're just getting hammered by everyone. Big companies want to destroy you. The government wants to destroy you. Other small companies want to destroy you. So it's a very and they're run by these entrepreneurial types that are super interesting to talk to and always thinking about the next thing.
And they just want to do the right thing. So they come to you and say, help us out.
Yeah. And so I got into that, and I started out as a litigator. I tried many, many cases over the years and slowly evolved into what is now largely a transactional lawyer. I help businesses kind of stay out of courtrooms more than when they get in. Occasionally I do trial work still, but because of the amount of clients I have, it doesn't make a lot of sense for me to get stuck in big trials.
We all know you as a person who's an expert on Apple products, but when you were in law school, wasn't that mostly PC oriented? Windows?
Yeah, it was. Those were some tough times, because I was in the early 90s, and in fact, my big tech through law school was a Tandy WP1, I believe. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that. It was basically a keyboard with an 8-line LCD screen on it. And it ran on a couple of AA batteries, and all it did was spit out a text file. And I would use that in classes to, like I said, I was broke, so I didn't have like an IBM or, you know, they had some pretty nice laptops then, or laptops were starting to get nice, but I just had this crappy little keyboard with an LCD screen. And by LCD, I mean, it was like, I think the pixel count was like something like 16 by 16 for each letter, 16 pixels up and down for each letter. And, but it was great, because I could just sit there and type in that. Like I said, it would run on batteries for a month, and then I'd cable it into a regular computer to get the text file out of it.
Well, see, and if we were in the early 90s, then we were looking at things like the PowerBook 100 and the 170.
Yeah, that was out of like my, was out of my budget.
And those, I think, so it was expensive. Yes, they were.
I think that was OS 6 at that time. I don't remember now.
System 6.
Yeah, System 6, not OS 6, of course. And I'd used Macs all through college. And as I started getting started in the practice of law, I did a lot more PC stuff for a while. But then I got back to the Mac.
Is it still true that there's a preference for Windows amongst attorneys because of tradition, or better support for accessing databases, or is it just what?
I don't know. I feel like that definitely was the case for a long time. I used to go into courtrooms with a Mac and people would laugh at me and, hey, you got your toy computer. And I always thought it was funny because they would laugh right until the knife slipped between their ribs because, you know, presentations off the Mac were so much better and like the stuff I could do with it. I mean, a lot of my trials over the years have been against larger firms. And one of the things I always try to do is go in alone. Even if I've got support staff, I don't want the jury to see this team of people. I want them to identify to me. And using the Mac, I was able to there's something that just worked, you know, for me and my personality. Cause I'm not like super aggressive. Again, I go in there, I'm kind of like folksy and that worked for me, but the Mac was a key part of it. And they did make fun of it. But then I'm a speaker every year in Chicago at the American Bar Association. They have a thing called Tech Show where basically it's ground zero for all the legal nerds in the country. And we all get together and I teach about either the Mac or some other bit of technology. And when I first started going to that, I was one of the only people with a Mac. And now I go and I think almost probably there's more people with Macs than anything else. So,
okay. Good.
It is evolving. And as younger people are coming into the profession, they're used to using Macs. The interesting thing will be in a few years is will people be using laptops? But that's another story.
It is. And I want to continue that discussion in a minute. But first, we have to take a break. Folks, we're going to be right back. We're going to hear from Kelly, and then we'll continue chatting about Apple and tech with David Sparks. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Oh, thank you, Kelly. I'm chatting with David Sparks, author and podcaster. David, how did you get into the Mac world so deeply? I mean, everything you do, you're so knowledgeable about everything involving Apple. It seems like it's your whole life, and yet you still have time to do your day job, too.
I kind of live a double life. I have always been a nerd. I mean, it's deep in my roots. I don't know how else to put it. And I've always been interested in automation and using technology to serve me. You know, I guess my particular niche in this circus is I'm always looking for ways to make the computer do things so I don't have to. And as kind of the lone wolf mentality that I've always had, it allows me to get home sooner, or allows me to go work on something else, or spend time with my kids, or whatever. So that's always been my particular obsession, and I share it. And over the years, it's kind of grown. I mean, it started out as a blog, and then I did some speaking, and in 2009, Katie and I started the Mac Power Users, and I'm always kind of growing the stuff I do. I've got several books I've written and things like that. And
how did you meet Katie? She's an attorney also, Katie Floyd we're talking about.
Yeah, she's an attorney as well. We met at Macworld, like so many people in our community. Macworld was the gathering place. And Katie was a lawyer nerd as well. Everybody said, you should know Katie. She's like you. So we hung out together, and it just, you know, it wasn't, we weren't sure we'd make a podcast together. We spent a lot of time talking about ideas because I didn't want to make just another podcast like every other one. You know, at the time, every podcast seemed like it was a copy of Mac Break Weekly. And I'm like, why do you want to do that? Mac Break Weekly is really good at being Mac Break Weekly. But the show I always wanted was one that would give me a lot of content, like usable stuff, you know, getting back to my idea of productivity. So I said, what if we just made a show where we took on a problem with every episode, you know, email or whatever the problem is. Mm-hmm. Or we just did a show on iCloud versus Dropbox, for instance. Pick a specific topic and then just beat the hell out of it. You know, go deep as you want on it. Be as nerdy as you want. And Katie's like, that's a great idea, but we'll run out of content in 10 shows. And now we just recorded 335, I think. So it's working out.
What kind of technology did one use on a Mac in 2009 to record and produce a podcast?
It really hasn't changed that much for us. The when we started, I think we both had kind of starter mics. I believe I had a USB mic at the time. And we used Skype and Skype Call Recorder. It was still around back then.
Mm-hmm.
We used GarageBand. We used, I forget the name of the app. There was
an
app.
Has GarageBand been around that long? Since 2009?
Oh, yeah. Okay. GarageBand was better back then. It allowed you to put markers in for, you know, enhanced podcasts. And we, boy, I forget the name of it now because we don't use it anymore. But there was Levelator. We'd use Levelator at the end. Hmm. We did want high production values because one of the things I felt like is with a podcast, bad audio is just a non-starter. It doesn't matter how good the content is. If you can't understand the person or if it's noisy or, you know, scratchy background, it's just too hard to listen to. So we try to do it really good from the beginning. And over the years, we've evolved a little bit. We've bought a little better equipment. I'm on a better mic now. But, you know, the beauty of podcasting is just about anybody can get into it for a couple $100.
Yeah, I'm kind of new to myself into the project. I've done about a year's worth of shows on background mode. Had a lot of fun. Learned a lot. The TMO team has taught me a lot about microphones and recording technology. You can really get into it deep. It's very technical, and it's hard to do really well, as you said, because there's so many things that can go wrong, or distractions, or incorrect technique, or sneezing into the microphone, or
yeah,
barking dogs.
It all happens, yeah.
It all happens. So what are some of your favorite technologies that you use on the Macintosh? We were talking in the pre-show about dictation. This was one of them.
Yeah, it's funny because I just wrote an article as we record this about the new Dragon Professional. I'm a big user of not only the Mac but also iOS. I don't even own a laptop anymore, which is kind of a new thing in my life, because the iPad Pro has turned out such a great mobile device for me. Don't get me wrong, I'm at an iMac at least 5 hours a day, but but when I'm not at my desk, the iPad is great. So that's kind of fun. I'm learning kinds of new workflows and things to be more productive on iOS than I have.
Can you produce your podcasts on the iPad Pro?
No, that's one thing that you can't do. I mean, it's possible, but it is like getting a root canal for the hell of it. It's just not worth it.
It's so easy to do with Audio Hijack and Loopback and Skype and editing with a really cool tool from Rogue Amoeba called Fission, which allows you to edit compressed audio. So
yeah.
I don't know how I would do it either.
Well, the big hang up is the ability to monitor, to have two streams of audio. I mean, on the Mac, it's easy to have one application monitoring the audio stream to record it and one monitoring audio to communicate. Like you and I are talking together through Skype, but we both have Call Recorder or some app out mm-hmm. there recording our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the hang up is on iOS. And I know that Apple's aware of it. My guess is they're going to at some point throw a switch and make that possible.
I've always had this fantasy, you know, watching a few years ago, there was this great show on Fox called Terra Nova. And they had these fabulous, beautiful big screens, like a chunk of glass about a meter wide. And it looked like the iPad of the future. And I've used it in some of my articles. And I've often thought that, you know, one of these days I'll be sitting in front of this 30-inch display iPad that looks like a thin piece of glass, and I'll be touching it and moving, dragging things around my fingers and doing the iOS-y kind of stuff on a big touchscreen.
Oh, and I think you'll get there. There's no doubt. I mean, this format of is not going away. We had a family event, and my 2-year-old nephew, we were watching TV, and my 2-year-old nephew walked up and he swiped the screen of the television, and everybody laughed at him, you know. But
there was a great story about that a few years back about a New York Times writer whose child was playing with a magazine on the coffee table because the iPad had died.
Yeah, I believe
it. And the kid picks up the magazine and does some little motions and says, "Daddy, it's broken."
Well, you know, I really believe he looked at us like we were idiots when we laughed at him. And I think he's right. I think by the time he gets older, I mean, a lot of this stuff is going to be touch sensitive, and that's just going to be the way things roll.
What about, what do you think about the so-called Steve Jobs gorilla arm effect?
Well, I guess we'll just figure it out, won't we?
Yeah, I guess we'll have to.
I mean, I think that partly goes into the thing I'm saying about dictation software. I mean, it's the traditional keyboard is not going to be as big of a deal for the next generation. And having teenagers, I can already see. I mean, I beg them to take typing classes, and they're not interested in it. They would rather type on glass. They're fine with it. And as the computers get better and better at listening to us, maybe, you know, the typists are the dinosaurs of our generation.
We're sort of at an inflection point, I think. We're not quite there yet with Siri, in terms of Siri being an artificial intelligent agent that's astute enough to take on all the tasks we want to take on. But she's getting there. So is Cortana. Yeah.
The interesting thing is there's a lot of people trying to come up to solve this, to crack this nut. And that's what I think is great, because competition is going to drive this stuff forward.
We got off track a little bit about dictation. Tell me more about your work with Dictation Engine.
Well, I just think dictation works, and a lot of people don't know. I'm here to share the good news. Dictation can work now. And like, for instance, just to give you an example, when I wake up in the morning, a lot of times I'll go through the email for the last 12 hours, and I've got all these systems to kind of filter my email for me. So usually I've got maybe 10 emails that really need my attention. And I can sit there with, I use it with Dragon, but you could probably even pull this off with the built-in dictation in Mac OS 10, or I guess Mac OS. I'm sorry, I have to get used to the new language. But I just open a window in a dictation, like a text window, and I just start dictating all my responses. And I'll dictate, like if I read an email, I'll dictate the response to the email. I'll dictate a note to somebody who's helping me out with something. I'll dictate
a note within a mail app sender?
No, I do it in just a text file. Byword, the Byword app. And then I don't spend time processing the email. I just sit there and talk through everything. I'll even make the billing entries for it. I'll say, you know, Dear John, you know, new paragraph, it was great talking to you on your podcast, period. I loved being on your show, period. I can't wait to hear when it comes out, period. New paragraph, thanks, new paragraph, David. So I just go through and I just like do that, and I'll put dash dash between each one. I just literally say dash dash and draws two dashes. And I just grind through like a stack of email like that. And it takes me about 15 minutes to get all that text in there. And then I can start going through, and then I can put on the news or whatever and have something background noise as I just, you know, proofread and block and copy these things into emails or into OmniFocus tasks or whatever. And it's just a super efficient way for me to work, and I never touch the keyboard the whole time. And I think a lot of people don't realize that that stuff's possible now.
Has dictation made any quantum leaps, or has it just been a slow process of refinement? Because I know a lot of people think about dictation as having quirks and trouble with homonyms and things like that.
It has just gotten slowly better, I would say. Although there are, like, one quantum leap they made. When I first started on this train, you had to put a space between every, you know, and then they got naturally speaking, where you could just say a sentence and it would put it together for you. One of the big improvements, they just released Dragon Professional version 6 on the Mac, and one of the big improvements now is using the accessibility APIs on the Mac, Dragon is able to go back and look at the words on the screen. You know, before, it had to assume that you weren't fiddling with the keyboard while you were dictating. And the way to mess up a dictation would be to go and change a word or something while you were dictating, because then the cursor gets lost and the program doesn't know where it's at, and just all hell breaks loose, you know. So with this new version 6, though, they're able to tap into the accessibility API so the application can constantly look at the screen and see the words. So you can dictate and then go in and make changes with the keyboard while you're dictating, which is a big leap. It doesn't work with every app, but it works with anything that supports the accessibility API, like Scrivener, Pages, I haven't tried it in Microsoft Word yet. But, you know, so it works in most of a lot of the applications that allow you to process words. So that's a nice big leap in the new version.
Do you foresee a day when these AI agents like Cortana and Siri will try to subsume that task of listening and creating dictation, or do you think it'll always be app-oriented?
I think it needs to become incorporated into the system. I mean, Apple has done that to, you know, Siri dictation on the iPhone is quite good. I sent you an email earlier today just confirming. I did that while I was sitting in my car. Mm. Yeah, just dictated a note to you, and I didn't even proofread it, so I don't know. You can tell me if there's any typos.
I've done that too, but with Siri messages. Yeah.
Yeah, same thing, you know. And so, and then on Mac OS, they've got the ability to have the system go in and do dictation for you. Yeah, it's built in now. You just have to function key twice. And that's not as good as Dragon for a couple of reasons, you know, no custom vocabulary, and there's just, you know, it's just not quite as good, but it's free. And if you're interested, that's a good place to start.
Cool. Cool. All right. Well, do you want to talk about Sierra and your reaction to it, or do you want to just kind of wrap it up?
Well, I mean, Sierra is not that big of a change, really.
You know, one of the things that annoyed me about Sierra was the storage management.
Yes.
The storage management of Sierra seems weird, poorly thought out, bad user interface. Jeff and I were talking about it the other night at a mug. And it just seems like Apple went overboard with trying to be too cute in rolling out content to the cloud emptying your trash for you and inviting you to delete files. It almost seems like Apple felt like people were, you know, overflowing their machines and desperately needed more room. And it might be part of this movement from big terabyte drives to smaller SSDs, but still, that was one part of Sierra that was kind of annoying for me, and I've turned it all off until I understand it better.
Well, I think that's absolutely the problem, is that you have people now have more cloud storage available to them than they have storage space to match on their devices. It's not unusual to see somebody with a 256 gigabyte MacBook, but have a terabyte of storage in Dropbox or iCloud. Mm. And the problem I feel like is Apple they built the bridge too far. You know, they said, okay, just click one box and we will handle this for you. That may work for a lot of people. I don't know, but I think it's not fully baked yet, so it's scary and dangerous.
It seemed a little alien to me, like you said, all on or all off. And your first reaction to that is, wow, this is new. I don't understand this. This is sort of overwhelming. I got to be careful here.
Well, and if you look at Dropbox Infinite, which is it's not released yet, but it's Dropbox's kind of idea for the same thing, where it says, okay, we're going to make you're going to have a 0-bit file on your computer that says, you know, Star Wars movie. And you're going to have saved it to Dropbox, and we are not actually going to put the file on your computer, but you're going to see everything, which is far superior to what Dropbox does now when you want to disable something where it doesn't sync to that. You know, selective sync is a mess with Dropbox. So everybody's like trying to tackle this problem, but Dropbox is much more granular. And like one of the things you can do with the Dropbox model, assuming that they release it and consistent with their video so far, is it's going to say, you know, save this file on my computer. Do not put this in the cloud. You know, there's like a trigger you can throw, a toggle. So you can say, well, I'm going to be on an airplane. I want to watch the Star Wars movie. I don't want Dropbox to automatically put it in the cloud for me.
Right.
Whereas the iCloud version of this right now is saying, don't worry, your pretty little head. I'll take care of it for you. And that is that can be vexing, especially for nerds.
Yes.
So that's one set of problems. The other set of problems is frankly, performance and reliability, which isn't entirely proven at this point. In fact, there's some stories out there of people losing files with this going on, which is, you know, the worst thing that could happen. But assuming they get that ironed out, then the question becomes, you know, what makes more sense? For nerds, we definitely want more fiddly knobs and you know, buttons to push. Maybe for most people, they don't care. I don't know. But I would have to think that, you know, an executive that walks in to give a presentation to find out that their presentation has been moved to iCloud, and they don't have a way to get it right now. It's not going to be happy. Mm-hmm. You know? So I don't know how this all plays out, but I think it's something that they need to address, but I think their first shot at it was a little too yeah. aggressive.
My advice is to clamp down, be careful, experiment, know what you're doing. Don't turn on everything at once in a new operating system. You know, read, learn, understand it, experiment, ease into it with confidence. Yep.
Yeah. The other thing I'd say about Sierra is, as the guy who just got done talking about dictation, I rarely use Siri on my Mac. I haven't really found much use for it.
I've read that it's not quite as sophisticated a version on the Mac as it is on iOS.
Well, it's the same generation. Yeah, it's the same root, I think. But I believe, you know, like, they've done some things differently. Like, the file search is kind of impressive, which is something you can't do on any of the other platforms. But, you know, they're trying to make it adapt to what would you need it for on a Mac. But I just don't find that much use for it. I need to force myself to use it more often to see if any of it gets sticky for me.
Cool. Well, guess what? We are out of time. We have just blown through 34 minutes.
Just like that.
Well, I want to thank you for being on the show and telling us about your background and your career. It's fascinating. Thank you very much. Tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Sure. You can find me at MacSparky.com. The podcast is MacPowerUsers.com. We're on the Relay Network, so you can also find us at RelayFM, relay.fm/MPU.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you came and joined me on the show, and this was a lot of fun. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.